I promised you two great Charlie Wheelers, which is rhyming slang for distinguished female intellectuals. And here comes the second one. It's that wonderful siren of the South, that poetic Taswegian, Margaret Scott. Now, some weeks back on the show, we had an altogether too brief chat with Margaret, cut short, as I said, by the declaration of the Third World War. So we decided to get her back onto the show and have a much longer, expansive, meandering natter about her life and her time at Cambridge with Sylvia Plath. Now, I also want to talk to her about her extraordinary dad. Let me remind you, because he's a strange fella. He fought in Mesopotamia during World War I. He was a fundamentalist. He thought that fossils had been littered about the earth by the devil. And he was also an Israelite. Tell us about that, Mark.
A British Israelite.
I recognise the distinction. I dropped the adjective.
There is a distinction. He really believed that because the Jews had blotted their copybook by crucifying the Son of God, the role of the chosen people had fallen on the British. He thought that the lost tribes of Israel had gone wandering off and by some means had all settled in Britain.
They did a lot of wandering, didn't they, Margaret? They wandered thither and yon. They got to America, they got to India.
They got to a lot of places. I could never quite pin him down on this. He didn't really like talking about it very much. I said, are you arguing that some of them were Normans, some of them were Jutes, some of them were Romans, so they all sort of mixed up in the British Isles? But he would never really give me an answer to that. Anyway, what he was quite sure about was that the British had inherited the role of the Israelites as God's chosen people. And that was why there was the British Empire. The British were chosen to lead.
I must point out that historically that's been a dangerous notion, and those holding that view have been heavily punished for it.
I'm afraid that is very true. Yes. And he was, poor old thing, because he couldn't believe that God would let the chosen people cease to be the chosen people. He thought that the European Economic Union was the work of the devil, the great beast, 666. And he thought that God would intervene to stop the signing of the Treaty of Rome. I actually have a letter, one of the last letters he wrote me, in which he says that he believes God will stop Britain joining this union. And in that glorious hope, I wish you a very happy Christmas, he said.
No wonder you have developed an appreciation of life's absurdities.
Well, yes, I relish the strange. I mean, it was absurd. It was quite absurd. But he had been dealt a very difficult hand in his life, and I think he needed to feel that he mattered. He needed to feel that he was somebody's chosen son, because his parents hadn't seen him that way at all.
He wasn't, of course, happy with the Darwinian theory. That sort of background wasn't good enough. And I understand that you had a few rows with Dad about Charlie.
Well, it was more my poor brother who had rows. I was 6 years younger than my brother, and he headed straight into the rows, and I sat eating my dinner and watching all this going on. Occasionally I weighed in, but mostly I just observed these awful clashes and decided there was no future in them. Nobody seemed to talk much sense in these exchanges.
So you began life as a pluralist.
I suppose I did.
Did you discuss anything with your dad? Did you discuss books, ideas, other than the Darwinian?
I think this was one of the problems. He had very, very little formal education. And he just didn't know about reading books. Neither he nor my mother had grown up as readers or thinkers. And although some very extraordinary people who don't have that in their background manage to acquire it for themselves, I think it's quite rare, actually. It's all very well for those who grow up in houses where there are books and where people take it for granted that you read and you talk and you think and you discuss ideas at breakfast. But there are millions of households where that doesn't happen.
Well, I grew up in, well, my first 8 years was lived in a house where there literally was not a book, not even a phone directory, because we didn't have the phone on.
Right. Yes, well, you obviously managed to acquire this for yourself.
Read comics.
You read comics.
Captain Marvel, Superman, Batman and Robin. That's how I got educated.
And you went on from comics. How did you get on to things more substantial than comics?
Well, I used to go to the local library and when I'd read all the William books...
Oh, yes.
And all the Biggles books.
Yes.
The librarian took me up the step into the grown-ups library and thrust a book in my hand, which changed my life. And it was Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, which led inevitably, you know, to all sorts of arcane political views. But I'm interrogating you, woman.
Now, I was just wondering, how old were you when you read Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath?
I was eight.
Now... Interestingly, my poor Uncle Reg, my mother's only brother by that time, who fought in the First World War in Flanders and would come home on leave and sit for 48 hours without speaking and then go back to the shells and the trenches with the dead floating in muddy water, he committed suicide. He jumped into Henley's Lake, and like all the rest of my family except for me, and there may be something significant in this, he couldn't swim. And he left us his bookcase. It was like a chest of gold. And I started in the top left-hand corner and worked my way down. And sometimes I cheated and jumped ahead to some particularly delicious-looking morsel, but mainly I tried to work my way book by book through the shelves down to the bottom right-hand corner.
You obviously had the same appetite for reading as I did. I'd read literally the label on a golden syrup tin.
Well, that's it. Yes, and this was all new. It's hard to imagine now. I didn't know any of the names. I had no presumptions, no expectations. I went through the whole of Kipling, an awful lot of Tennyson, a lot of Dickens, things like The Three Musketeers, Georgette Heyer, whom I loved passionately. There were some rather funny little novels with names like Her Mad Month and Pink Sugar. There were the short stories of O. Henry.
Oh, they were great, weren't they?
Oh, they were fabulous and had a very strong influence on what I still think of as good short stories.
Do you remember the O. Henry story set in a place called Summit, which was in the middle of a flat Midwestern plain?
Doesn't matter.
But almost every second paragraph was a delight in O. Henry. He was a master of the form.
He was. He was just brilliant. And with that very delicate, subtle... way of conveying sort of the kinds of feelings which matter so much but are not technicolour. You know, sort of shyness and small thwarted ambitions and affection, all those things. Just wonderfully good at it.
But O. Henry wasn't as gifted at writing plots as your father. And I'm now thinking about the plot of his own life as you lately, or, you know, much down the track as you discovered it. Tell us about the double life, the parallel universes.
Well, I've probably made it sound more romantic and fascinating than it really was, but basically what happened was this. When he was very young, his parents gave him away. He was adopted by a watchmaker who lived in Bristol, who was quite a pleasant man, and his very far from pleasant wife. And he went to live with them. He left London, where the rest of his family were. He went to live in Bristol. He had this story about how when he was sent on errands to shops, his Cockney accent was so strong no one could understand him. He had to go back and get everything written down. It was an awful humiliation. He never quite got over that. Well, when he grew up, he married very happily, I think, and had two children. But he never told us that he knew who his parents were, his real parents, or that he had various siblings with whom he kept in touch. I think he just couldn't bear to tell us that he, of all the family, had been singled out for rejection and given away. So he maintained a relationship with one brother and the wife of another who was killed in the First World War, I think, and never told us.
Now, you discovered this at the funeral because you're confronted with your siblings.
Yeah, actually, again, I'm afraid I've taken a few liberties with the truth, and two of the books that I've produced this year are really about that.
I think you can make a clean breast of it now, on the wireless.
Well,
treat this as a confessional, you fibber.
On the wireless. I didn't actually go to the funeral. I was out here, and it was a time when I had a lot of children and stepchildren of various ages, and it was just very, very difficult to get back to England for the funeral. My brother handled it all, but I went back to England and saw my brother not so very long after that. And it was then that he showed me the marriage certificate of our grandparents and my father's birth certificate, documents that were quite astonishing to us because we thought he'd been left on a step in a shoebox or something of this kind and just didn't know who he really was. Also, cousins emerged from the New Forest saying that he'd been very good to them and this kind of thing. So I actually got there rather later than I make it sound.
But nonetheless, the elements are true, and that is that at the funeral, one family is confronted by the other, and the initial reaction is that these interlopers are sort of weirdos who are trying to get an invite to the wake
That's
for a
right.
free feed.
What we have here is a rather curious situation in that there's one book that came out earlier in the year called Changing Countries, which is a kind of mixture of essays and short stories and poems. And now there is a novel called Family Album. And to some extent, they at least touch on similar things. I mean,
they're both absolutely delightful books. But I'm glad we've made a clean breast now. Now we know what categories we're talking about.
But if you put them together, I mean, they are both on their own.
This is a marketing ploy. This is how people have got to buy two books and put them together.
Well, not necessarily. they are both about turning life into fiction and how difficult it is to tell the truth, how impossible, really, because memory is fallible and so on.
Okay, let's leave that stage in your life behind, at least for the time being, and jump ahead to Cambridge. Now, we spoke briefly about this. And your involvement in circles like the Celtic Fringe with the aforementioned Sylvia and Ted. What was, if you'll forgive me invading what's left of your privacy, the Celtic Fringe?
Well, the Celtic Fringe was a group of people who were rather, I suppose, rebellious or different in some way from the general run of students. A friend of mine called Felicity christened them the Celtic Fringe. I don't think they even knew that that was their nickname, which she and I enjoyed. A lot of them were Irish. At least one was Welsh.
This wasn't, therefore, a class-based organisation.
No, it was very, it was more classless than most Cambridge organisations, I would say. It was very anti-authority. There was one young man who went around in an army surplus greatcoat, trying to live down his origins in Surbiton. He spent a
Surbiton's one of those places like East Cheam, isn't it?
Yes, it's a bit like East Cheam. And he was very, very much interested in left-wing politics and the union movement. And there were other people who I felt very strongly about Ireland, about the IRA. They sang rebel songs.
But as well as feeling strongly, you also felt strongly about having a good time, didn't you, as a group?
Yes, I think that could be said. They did all kinds of things. Some of them had a jazz band. They were all goers, I think you could say. A lot of them were writers. Some of them were actors. And they all sang songs together.
I'm going to read a fragment of prose from your pen. It describes someone. I want you to identify this person. She was tall and frightening. She wore white knee-length socks, a kilt and a pageboy hairstyle, and strode about the corridors looking like the Hitler Youth.
Oh, yes, well, that was Sylvia Plath in her blonde phase. I really, as a young person, was quite signally dumb in many ways. I seem to have had almost a genius for getting things wrong, you know. I thought Sylvia was immensely confident. I thought she was rather superficial and lacking in any real talent.
One out of three ain't bad.
Also, on the famous occasion when Sylvia met Ted at the St. Botolph's Review party in Falcon Yard, party at which I was very present, as it were, my friend Shirley, who had come to the party with Ted, said to me, "He kissed that American girl, you know." And I said, "I'm sure it doesn't mean anything."
Have you always had this extraordinary depth of perception? You sound like A.D. Hope reviewing Patrick White.
Well,
oh, dear.
I think I'm just a little bit more perceptive now. Not always.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear it. Now, Sylvia wrote, and this is I quote from your text, that the English girls are impossible, intellectually brilliant, but emotionally and socially like nervous, fluttery, adolescent teenagers. Is that a vivid portrait of you?
Well, I don't know about the intellectually brilliant. I'd love to embrace that bit, but I'm not sure that I can. Sylvia wrote that in one of her letters to her mother, I believe. I was very, very nervous. I was intense. intensely nervous. How fluttery that made me, it's hard to say at this distance of time. But I was really terrified because I felt I was out of my depth.
Margaret, isn't it good to finally, belatedly grow up? I mean, I've only grown up in the last 3 or 4 years, and you grow less nervous, not so much more confident, as the other things drain away, don't they?
Well, I think you care less about what people think about you. I find I care much more now about, I don't like to call them causes, about what is happening in the world around me. And I don't really mind or even think very much now about whether people think my hair looks good or, you know, whether I'm wearing the right shoes or driving the right car. I mean, I really do feel that that's of no interest anymore, or very little.
And that is very liberating, isn't it?
It's very liberating. It really is immensely liberating. And it does leave you free to concentrate on things that matter more. That may sound rather priggish and boring, but I do feel something very like that.
Look, I'll just conduct a poll among the listeners. Does that sound priggish or boring? No, they all don't think it does at all. I think you sound terrific.
That's very nice of them.
Let's bound like a couple of marsupials. Let's leap through the decades like kangaroos. Let's get to Tassie and 1959. Yeah. Why Tasmania? Were you rejected by the Americans or something? What
no,
happened?
No. I didn't want to go anywhere. I was very happy where I was. I, at that time, liked England very much. We were living in the most beautiful part of Sussex. We had a lot of friends. Because we were quite close to London, although living on this rural estate, all kinds of friends from university days came down to see us for the weekend. So we really did have a very lively social life. We had a very delightful child. We used to go out to the pictures on a motorbike. And I quite liked what I was doing. I was teaching bits of Latin and doing other things like that. And we had a beautiful garden. So I, at the time, was quite contented, but the chance came to come here. There was a Tasmanian girl teaching music in the school where we were both teaching. She and one of our friends became enamoured of each other and got engaged and decided they were coming back to Tasmania. "Why don't you come?" they said. "You only have to come for 2 years. You
Isn't
come
life
out.
Infinitely arbitrary?
Isn't
it's like tossing
it?
Coins for decisions, isn't it?
I know, and you make, I mean, at the age of 16 or 18, when really I had the brain of a mouse, I made these immense decisions, which at the time didn't seem so significant, but which, of course, changed my life and that of many other people. So we thought we would come. We could come as £10 migrants. And we were going to
stay
2 years.
Well, that's £5 each or a total of £20. I want to see if we got value for money
here. I think it was £10 each.
Right.
And we, at that time, there was a great shortage of teachers in Tasmania. So we were visited by the Director of Education, Mr. Triboulet. And he was sweeping about English-speaking countries in other parts of the world, trying to entice people to come and teach in Tasmania. So off we went. And here I am. I'm still here.
We noticed. Now, I know that back home you'd planned to write a novel in verse about the evolving consciousness of a fetus.
Oh, that was, I'd never, was quite that silly. That's an invention.
Oh, is it? Oh, what a pity. I liked that. I thought that was great. But I only want to mention, let poetry raise its attractive head at this point, because you get to Tassie, but you don't really start publishing poetry until the mid-70s. And, of course, in 1974, you clever thing, you're in an anthology of the world's best poems. Now, this sounds like a quick learning curve for someone who professes to be profoundly dull.
Well, I'd been secretly writing verses since the age of 8 or younger. I had a little book of verse published by a vanity publisher. I didn't realise he was a vanity publisher at the time. When I was 10, it was called The Impatient Crocus.
What rhymes with precocious? Is that right? A 10?
A 10. It was a terrible book. It was very moralistic. All the little poems were full of moral lessons, like The Impatient Crocus insists on bursting up into the upper world when the snow is still lying on the ground. And so she's zapped by Jack Frost, and then her other sisters come up, and they saw her withered cup, and they all stand around shaking their heads, saying how terrible it is to be impatient.
That's sort of like a floral version of Schadenfreude, isn't it?
It is, yes.
God,
exactly.
I never thought of you as moralistic at any stage in your long career.
Well, I was a bit then, but I got over it,
yes.
I hope.
Now, how did you meet up with the likes of Macaulay? I mean, okay, you were very well connected back home. You knew the who's who of the elite arts. But you met up with Macaulay and get published in Quadrant.
Oh, well, Macaulay, I was working in the research branch of the education department, and Macaulay came to see me because he wanted somebody to do some research on handwriting. And while I had him in my grasp, I said, I'm getting a bit tired of writing speeches and reports and submissions and things. I've been wondering if I could do a PhD instead. And he started somewhat and said, well, I suggest you write some of it and let me have a look at it, and then perhaps we might be able to get you a teaching fellowship or something of that kind. And that is exactly what happened. He was very good to me, Macaulay. He was an extremely good...
He was better to you than he was to Max Harris.
Yes, he wasn't very fond of Max Harris, I have to say. But he was a very complicated man and extremely interesting. People become obsessed with Macaulay and they sit up all night trying to put all the pieces together, but they never quite succeed.
Well, I'm pleased to hear that. I don't think anyone should be that easy to read. You
know? He's not easy. He's the most difficult of people to read, I thought. But he always treated me extremely well. And he ran a strangely democratic English department.
Democratic in what sense?
Well, he always consulted everyone about everything we did.
Unheard of. Unheard of. But when he consulted, was he influenced by the consultation process, or did he go on and do what he was going to
anyway? He was influenced by it. And we had one meeting about the Vietnam Moratorium March, at which everybody said, we have a contract with the students. We cannot cancel our classes. We must teach. I was then too junior and too timid to say anything. But after the meeting, I went to see him and I said, I want to march. But what I will do is ask my class if they want their tutorial. If they do, I will give it and then I will run like hell and join on the end of the march before it finishes. If they don't want it, if they vote not to have it, we'll all go and march. And he said, well, I respect that. Now tell me why you feel so strongly.
Hmm.
this was not said in a hostile way. Or
a patronising way.
No, far from it. I think he was interested in anyone who felt passionately about anything.
Well, he'd found the right girl in you, Margaret. Now, you got a lot of encouragement from the likes of Gwen Harwood. You used to do poetry readings with her.
Yes, to some extent. Although there now are ever-increasing numbers of writers in Tasmania, many of them extremely good and bound for higher
Well, this
and
came from
things.
The breeding pair down there, did it?
Yes. Several breeding pairs, I think, were released into the wild. And also, a few flew in across Bass Strait. And now there are all these writers peeping out from behind trees in all directions.
Is that what they are? When I noticed these peeping things in Tasmania, I didn't realise they were writers.
They were probably writers. They might have been painters or photographers.
So it's now the Athens of the South. In other words, to hell with Adelaide.
Dublin. The Dublin of the South,
that's even more charming. And physically, of course, Hobart is more Dublin-esque, isn't it?
Oh, it's very Dublin-esque. And we've got a lot of pubs. And we have a lot of music. And, of course, rude jokes have been made about us for a long time. We have that in common.
Yes,
with
Barry
the Irish.
Humphries used to always say that if you flew to Tasmania, it was on a plane with a club wheel. But he's always been a very rude fellow, of course.
Yes. Well, yes, but, I mean, the Irish have had those sorts of jokes made about them, and it hasn't done them any harm, really.
Can I now have a dramatic change of mood? I have just been rereading Elegies to that you wrote on your husband's death.
Oh, yes, about Michael.
It is a gut-wrenching poem, as, of course, you know well, having written it. It's when you write a poem like that, is it to help you cope? Is it simply an act of tribute? What are the motivations? Does it simply have to be written?
I think something of all those. The thing I would say is that I think when you're very young, you write, you know, to express yourself. This is what you want to do. You want to express yourself. Later, I think you become intensely interested in rendering the experience, in sharing the experience, whether it's seeing a cat jump off a wall or falling in love or whatever it may be. And I think, too, you become wrapped up in trying to make a lovely thing, you know, as though you were making a table. You want it perfectly balanced, and you want it to be a pleasure to touch.
But there's also the great opportunity for the artist to emulate the oyster, you know, to take a bit of discomfort or pain and to turn it into a pearl. And you do that a lot. There's the poem about your hysterectomy, the death of your first child, your home burning to the ground in the Hobart bushfires of 1967.
I've never had a hysterectomy, actually. I love playing games, I think, putting on masks and beards and wigs.
Well, I'm glad that was a fiction. I think that's terrific. This is like Germaine Greer having a row with Richard Huzitz. Do you remember he accused her of having a hysterectomy and she was very cross?
Oh, Richard...
Richard Neville. It's Richard's fault. I blame Richard for this.
Yes. Well, but... indeed.
But let's get back to the point. The point being that whenever you are confronted with an appalling experience in your life, you do, in fact, tend to make it into a profoundly beautiful work of art.
Well, thank you for that. I think... Yes, the oyster analogy is a good one. I think you do start covering up covering up the pain by thinking about technique, by thinking about how to say what you want to say. With that first elegy, which I think is the best poem I've written, I wrote about 4 pages. And then over a period, I cut it down. But I had great trouble with it. It didn't fall onto the page by any means.
It doesn't read as though it did. There was one event in your life, but in the life of many, many, many others, which happened in 1996 on April 28, when Martin Bryant...
Oh, yes.
..went berserk at Port Arthur, and it's been said that that event came closest to finishing you off. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I don't know that that's true, because I was very fortunate. I wasn't there. I was never in danger of my life. And nobody really close to me was there. Many, many people I knew and liked, many people who lived in the district were there. But it didn't affect me in the awful direct way that it affected so many lives. So I've always feel slightly fraudulent about that. But what happened was Random House asked me to write about it just because I was a writer and was living very close to Port Arthur, as I still do.
I can remember the night it happened. I'm sitting in the studio here, and I'm hearing people, not you, I hasten to add, talking about Tasmania losing its innocence, and I always thought it was the silliest possible comment,
given
that where the event occurred is a theme park for human misery. And, of course, Tasmania has a dark history
of
genocide. But anyway, don't want to dwell on it. Look, why do you think that young people have taken to you with such enthusiasm? Here you are, you get a standing ovation when you go on Good News Week. And I can't think of a parallel case where there's such a generational gap so happily bridged.
Well, one person said to me, with great enthusiasm, "You remind me of my gran." And I do have a lot of grandchildren. Also, I spent a lot of my life teaching, and I had, I hope, quite a good relationship with many students. A lot of them are still my friends. Richard Flanagan, for example, or Peter Pierce, back in long ago years, were students in the English department where I was teaching. I wouldn't say I taught either of those two very much. I think the boot was on the other foot. But nonetheless, I've been connected with much younger people through much of my life.
Let me put another possibility to you. The young are deeply suspicious of the old these days, and they've got very good bullshit detectors. You know, the antenna are well-tuned. And I think one of the things I like about you is that you are totally devoid of bull. You know, you're just you. You just sort of walk on, and there you are. Take it or leave it.
Well, I suppose that's true. And I do like jokes. I love jokes. I collect jokes, and I like sending up the pompous when I get a chance, and I do feel very passionately about the plight of many young people at the moment, about what is happening to universities, about what is happening to those least able to defend themselves.
Well, as you were saying earlier, when you have a cause, it takes you out of yourself, doesn't it?
It does.
It reallocates focus and energies in the more creative way.
I become angrier by the day about much that is happening in Australia at the moment. But perhaps I shouldn't get onto that.
I think we'll just have a minute's silence and take that as read. Look, this is outrageous, but the last thing I want to ask you about, because it's such a lovely story, I want you to, you know, to listen to my voice. I'm taking you back in time, back, back, back. Watch the swinging watch. I want you to go back to the point when you were working in, of all places, an eyelash factory.
Oh, yes, in Welwyn Garden City. I really did do that. That was...
Note this, listener, she's confessed to telling the truth.
I really did. And on the other side of the room, there was a little group of ladies making false fingernails. But we were the eyelash girls. And we had to get this coiled stuff out of which the eyelashes were made off little rods, which poor creatures in the suburbs had wound around the rods and baked in their ovens. And then we had to trim it into graceful arcs and mount it in little boxes. Well, I could do some of that. The trouble was getting the two arcs the same. So, you know, I'd get one lovely sweep of eyelashes and that'd be great. And then I'd start on the other one and it'd be just a bit sort of off beam.
Are you saying that you sent women out into the world with an unfortunate squint?
No. What I'd lose my head completely. I'd get the second one straight, but it'd be much shorter than the first. So I'd shorten the first one, and then that'd be crooked, and it would end up like elfin barbed wire.
So those eyelashes you flutter at the nation in your new role as grandma to Australia, are they your own, Margaret?
Oh, yes. Yes, they're my own. They're my own, and they aren't even backed up by these little spikes that I used to produce back in those long ago days.
Margaret, it is a delight, and we've had a bit more time together today, but come back soon, because you're publishing a book every other week now. The book's under review, dear listener, include Family Album, published by Vintage, and Changing Countries, published by ABC Books, and they and hundreds of others, which will be out shortly, all written by Margaret Scott. See you, Margaret.
Thanks, Philip. Bye.
Margaret, we'll have to do this every week. All you've got to do is keep writing books at a rate of knots. The books discussed include Family Album, published by Vintage, and Changing Countries, published by ABC Books.